13. William Hendrickson, the great Reformed commentator, says, sections 2 to 7 of the Revelation keep covering the same ground from the first to the second coming of Christ. Everyone doesn't agree with that, but many people do. The sections of the book of the Revelation after the introductory section, chapter 1, the vision of Christ, is chapters 2 and 3, 4 to 7, 8 to 11, 12 to 14, 15 and 16, 17 to 19, and 20 to 22. This fourth section of the second half of the book, chapters 12 to 14, is difficult to follow because following chapter 12, which we looked at last Sunday evening, which deals with Christ's victory on the cross and the conflicts which ensued in the heavenlies and on earth, chapter 13 takes as its locus the early centuries of the Christian faith with the conflict between the Roman Empire and the Church, notably about the time of Nero. The sea here then represents worldly government, the sphere of the dragon, the devil, from which sea the horrid beast emerges. And the conclusion that the sea represents worldly government is proved by the ending of that sea, you remember, as such, in Revelation 21, which says there was no longer any sea. Now, that's not referring to the natural sea, and lovers of the sea will be glad to hear that. But this refers to worldly government, which in our chapter's terms stands for the pagan Roman Empire, but representing all the ungodly empires throughout Christendom. But the sea can be cruel too, and this one is horrible, like a hellish stew whence emerges this terrible beast. Now the thing is that these events are going on now, but they are here expressed in terms of the ancient conflict between the Roman Empire and the Christian Church, especially, as I say, about the time of Nero, or perhaps Caligula. The hurling down of Satan and the persecuting of the woman, which we read of in chapter 12, is an ongoing conflict. And we must accept that what we read in chapter 13 of these beastly goings-on is a prophetical account of the present ensuing conflict between Christ and Satan and his horrid crew throughout the Christian ages until Christ returns in power and glory. The seven heads represent successive empires spanning the sweep of, thus far, nearly 2,000 years of Christendom's history. The fact that these empires are described in terms of different sorts of animals, as in Daniel chapter 7, the leopard, the bear, and the lion, could tempt us, and have tempted many scholars, to try to identify some of the empires throughout Christian history, such as the Russian or the German empires, not to speak of the Victorian British Empire, if you see it as a worldly organization under Satan's tutelage, which, in view of Queen Victoria and her Bible, is surely going a bit far, wouldn't you say? You wouldn't say that about the British Empire, though it's far from perfect. The diadems are not wreaths of victory, but crowns of blasphemous authority, delegated by the dragon himself. The first thing the text tells us about this first beast is that it had been mortally wounded and had recovered. Now, this is thought to refer to the Roman Empire, especially under such as Nero, or some say Caligula, both of whom, this is the point, both of whom were thought to be so evil that they couldn't die, but could revive and continue their evil reigns of terror. You see, not only Julius Caesar, but the first divine emperor Augustus, you read of in the Bible, Claudius, Vespasian, and Titus, were all declared to be divine at their death, and therefore were regarded as not dead. Isn't that interesting? In view of their inability to believe in Christ's resurrection, their divine emperors might live forever, they believed, in some limbo or other, but not Jesus Christ. What perversity. You see that? Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2:9-10, the coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing. The whole world, of course, went after this beast, and New Age-wise worshipped the power which lay behind the beast, namely that of the dragon. And this obviously bespeaks a rise of cultism at the heart of the world and the world of affairs. Think of Waco. And much earlier, Jones was at Guyana, where more than 100 people committed suicide. And then these two women extradited to U.S. and the cult that they're involved with, you see. And the Japanese one. And you see, the rise of this kind of cultism soon extends to the worlds of politics and business. What is it that permitted one solitary man in a bank in Singapore to ruin a traditional bank to the tune of more than £800 million? What do you think? But surely some kind of sinister stupor which must have descended on the principles of the Barings Bank. Men who would formerly have been called hard-headed businessmen, but they proved themselves to be as irresponsible as silly little kids, which hadn't a clue. Is there something charmingly demonic about Leeson and prison, and was it Stuttgart in Germany? Perhaps his trial will reveal something. Indeed, one wonders why in recent years Lloyd's have been in such a mess, ruining many very wealthy clients. All these clever men, are all clever men fools? Surely not. What makes them go wrong? But then, look at the worlds of sport and entertainment and the degrees of satanic wickedness often associated with these worlds. And of course, the drug scene, which is presently preoccupying the whole world's attention because of the enormity of its worldwide problem, including the mafia and the drug barons of Colombia. Nothing new, you say, no? As far as the degree of wickedness is concerned, although older plots and ploys are not necessarily using the methods and the materials of the modern world, but nonetheless, the same kind of wickedness, only in more intense, as we are warned that wickedness will grow worse and worse as the age proceeds. In Moses' song of deliverance in Exodus 15, deliverance from the slavery of Pharaoh, there is a reference to the fear engendered in the hearts of other nations, pagan nations, which the commentator Charles suggests is a parody of godly praise, when these evil nations, highly, highly sensitized to all things superstitious and open to every conceivable kind of demonic representation, tremble at what the Lord has done. Moses says, anguish will grip the people of Philistia. The chiefs of Edom will be terrified. Leaders of Moab will be seized with trembling. The people of Canaan will melt away. Terror and dread will fall upon them. By the power of your arm, they will be as still as a stone until your people pass by, that is, on their way to Canaan. O Lord, until your people, the people you bought, pass by. You see, the truth is that what is described in verses 5 to 8 of our chapter, look at them. What is described there is not a picture of some remote and horrible evil age in the future, although since it is prophesied that evil will wax worse and worse during the period between the two comings of Christ, it will reach a peak and come to a climax, the climax of that final apostasy and revolt of all evil, which is going to usher in the coming of Christ. But the rise of this blasphemous beast during the 3.5 period between the two comings, here designated 42 months, is something which prevails during the whole of the Christian ages and affects all Christendom. The beast is given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. That's why I thought of what the regime in Burma has done to the Karen Christian people as an example of that. They've been dispossessed of home and land and are refugees in a land, Thailand, that doesn't want them. Terrible. We've seen Tom Scott has shown us pictures of those people. It's awful. That's happening today. Well now, if you think this is too outlandish and remote to apply to what's going on in the world today, just review in your minds, that is, to the extent you can recall, the chief events in the history of Christianity. Go to Turkey, Asia Minor, as it used to be called, where so much started, especially around Ephesus. And go there today and see the ruin. And Mohammed in control. Travel the length and breadth of the northern seaboard of Africa, from Egypt and Cairo to Morocco and the Atlantic, and look for signs of the flourishing churches which in Augustine's day prospered there. Go to Greece and back to Palestine and the Middle East. Go even to Beirut, where from the early years of this century there was such a flourishing Christian work in Beirut. And see the spiritual desolation there now. Go to the Balkans and see what Mohammed has done there, along with, obviously, demonic elements in the Orthodox and Roman churches, to decimate civilizations and drive thousands of poor souls to the hills to rot and die in what they call, horrid creatures, ethnic cleansing, which is just extermination. Those of you who have read Jung Chan's Wild Swans may recall some of the things that she says about Chairman Mao. He seemed incapable of repressing his love of fighting. As bloody wars spread across China during the Cultural Revolution, he said, "It's not a bad thing to let the young people have some practice in using arms. We haven't had a war for so long." What a madman. What a complete madman he was. And Yun Chang adds, "Human anguish did not concern Mao. People existed only to help him realize his strategic plans, fodder for his evil lust of absolute power, a god," he thought to himself. "And a rotten one." Then, look at the deadness of the Christian church in Europe. From Scandinavia. Who was it who was in Scandinavia? Oh, it was Dr. Paul Hull from Sri Lanka, who has connections as an engineering lecturer, has connections with Sweden, it is. And he said he found the church so dead, shocked at it. From Scandinavia all the way down to the south of Spain. Go to heathen France and then cross to Britain and see the pallor of the Christian church in all her huddled divisions. And think what Jesus Christ did when he rose from the dead and commanded his disciples to go into all the world and preach the gospel and make disciples of all nations. And you see, because the world population grows apace despite all attempts to curb it, and because the Christian church is seldom a match for the growth of other competing religions like sport and entertainment and war and weapons and big business and the drug scene, who's going to say other than that the powers of evil have come down to wage war against the saints and, on the whole, conquer them? And that overspread of wickedness and evil covers, our chapter says, every tribe, people, language, and nation. Oh no, they have not quenched the Christian church, although they have, practically speaking, in some nations which formerly flourished with the gospel. But where there is blight and decay in one land, the gospel is flourishing in other places, like in parts of Africa and Korea, of course, and Indonesia. And it survives, at least in Britain. For there are many in our land, maybe more than for many a day, despite being lost in the midst of the population explosion. Many in our land today who have not worshipped the beast, like the 7,000 Elijah didn't know about, but the Lord knew, whose names have been written, John says, in the Lamb's Book of Life from the foundation of the world. But nonetheless, you see, it's a sair fecht, isn't it? And a great warfare, demanding constant vigilance, courage supreme, to keep going despite every discouragement from a worldly church, and much more from a worldly government. Think of the appalling corruption of the media, newspapers, magazines, screens, loudspeakers, loud halos almost. This net thing, what an evil lies behind some of that. And the gambling disease. I wonder when the Prime Minister is going to express his shock at what he's done with the lottery. I think he's afraid to say so, but he must be shocked. The nation's gone mad on greed. And over against all that now, the one virtue of the saint, amid their sore trials, to maintain anything like a decent witness against the floods of increasing wickedness. Well, take the licensing board at Aberdeen, which refused to listen to the chief constable as he warned them about allowing another great nightclub to open in the city centre. When they're all clamoring for longer opening hours, so that, as our brother Arnold would say, who lived on Union Street and could tell you all about it, instead of riotousness breaking out when these hell holes spill out at 2 o'clock in the morning, it would be 3 and even 4 in the morning by the time that our main streets would become a shambles, as if something like a hurricane of vandalism had hit it. I was saying, the one virtue of the saints, amid their sore trials to maintain anything like a consistent witness against the floods of wickedness, the one virtue is faithfulness. See that in our chapter? Not success, but faithfulness to the truth, whatever the outcome of that witness may be. And you know, when the Christian church has to live its life and maintain its witness in face of such dire opposition as we read of here, then nothing but what John calls patient endurance is of any value at all. For you see, we're not serving the Lord with our eyes on what man says or thinks, but what God thinks. I was surprised the other day when a neighbor said to me, "You're aye in the papers." I said, "Only for a wee while." I said, "Do you think that affects me?" "You don't know. You don't know what I work through the years, or you wouldn't say that. Never." But then, here's another beast erupting, not out of the sea of worldly government, but worse, out of the earth, like a lamb, but really a dragon. What in the world is this? Ah, This is religion under the power of the state. That's what it is. Religion of a kind under the power of the state. But it is soon clear that the second beast is under the power of the first beast, who himself is under the power of the dragon. It's all commanded by the devil himself. And we have seen plenty of this within the lifetime of many of us. Think what Nazism did to the Christian church, and what Niemöller and Bonhoeffer suffered. Some of you remember that so long ago? Think what Soviet communism did to the Christian church in Russia and Europe, Eastern Europe, and what China has done to the Christian church there. You see, these horrors that we read in this chapter are more up to date than we thought. But note that this beast emerging from the earth suggests that it represents earthly wisdom, the kind Paul writes about when he says, God has made foolish the wisdom of the earthly world, for it is by its so-called wisdom that it refused to know God. It was by its so-called wisdom that it refused to know God, he says. 1 Corinthians 1:20-21. James says, such wisdom is earthly, unspiritual, of the devil. And Paul again says, it glories in its shame, minding earthly things. Philippians 3:19. But you see, as we go on through the chapter, we read of even more lurid and horrible things, of a world absolutely dominated by hideous wonders. And we may say to ourselves, this is not quite our world today, eh? It's not as bad as that yet, is it? No? But as we sweep on, presumably we are coming nearer the end time, when even Joel, you remember, quoted by Peter on the day of Pentecost, said that God would show wonders in the heavens above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and billows of smoke, the sun turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming of the great and glorious day of the Lord. Acts 2:19-20. What then are we to make of these things? Anything practical? Anything that can mean anything to us today? First, they are yet to come. The worst of them are yet to come at the climax. The world is yet to see these catastrophic and cosmic wonders. Make no mistake about that. It therefore behoves us to be sober. This is the lesson, for me at any rate, tonight. It therefore behoves us to be sober about our prospects as Christians and Christian workers in this ungodly world. I think the effect of all this on me is to rid my heart of any ambition in Christian service as to statistics, and indeed to repent every time I have claimed any advantages for the Christian church in our midst. All that matters when my record is read before the judge of all the earth will be whether I have been faithful, and no statistics, I think, will be given then, but just a record of either my faithfulness or my faithlessness. And when I thought of that, it shook me. For if I say, as I have often said, one way or another, I have association with between 400 and 500 biblical ministers in Scotland, not to say beyond Scotland, which is between a quarter or a third of the ministry in our denomination. That's a boost. That's a boost. And how many of those are absolutely true? That's what God is concerned about. And that's his affair, not mine. It's how many are faithful, not how many there are, or how large their congregations or their followings are. According, therefore, to the closing passage of our chapter, what we should all be doing, whatever the state of the church should be vis-a-vis the world, is to say to ourselves, should the restrictions on Christians in our land, as in Germany during the Nazis, and in Soviet Russia and China during communist regimes, be such as to make it difficult for us even to buy or sell, and that only those with the hideous mark of the beast on them were acceptable, then how would I take that? In my earlier days, indeed during the late 50s and into 1960, you remember when Khrushchev was banging his shoe on the table at UN, and before Kennedy called his bluff concerning Cuba, I used to say, and I got into trouble for saying this by many, if the communists ever overrun our country, I may end my days in prison. But the truth, you see, as predicted, is much worse than the world has yet seen. We've read terrible things in that chapter tonight. Whether we live to see them or not, somebody will live to see them. Somebody will. Jesus says the days of these awful coming events will have to be shortened, otherwise no one will be saved. What do you think of that? Isn't that awful? So let's face it, this is a sobering and a humbling, I hope perhaps also a sweetening word, but it's certainly a sobering one and a humbling one. That's how I feel it. But then, to conclude, as to the number of the beast. We've spoken a good deal, both in the mornings concerning Elijah, and in the evenings about the perfect number 7 as representing the time between the first and second comings of Christ, with the first half of 3.5, whether counted in days or months, or years, as the time of the church's tribulation on earth. 3.5, half of the perfect 7 of the church's tribulation on earth throughout Christendom. And the second half, the coming of the Lord himself to perfect his work and establish his kingdom. Then, however many sixes there are, 6 never attains to 7. And 7 is God's number, is the perfect number. That's obvious all through the Bible. You'd be very dumb if you never saw that. 6 never attains to 7 and ever falls short of it, and therefore cannot endure, but must fall away, as it will, to eternal hell. So, the debate about church and state, which goes on between Scotland and England, is a fascinating area of study and practice. And each country, of course, has its own balance as far as the two of them are concerned. The coronation being governed by the state and the church together. Whereas in Scotland, the Queen sits outside the assembly when she is there and is invited to speak to the fathers and brethren. She has no right to do so. But even so, you see, the prevailing religion of the day tends to affect both the life of the church and the life of the state. And the two can walk together in such high-handed agreement that the word of God may take second place to what the current theological opinion may be. And a prime minister may reject a superior cleric of the Church of England as bishop because of doctrinal or other pressures. And you see, the government of their church could be affected by those who are not moved by the highest biblical standards. I think, you know, we are in greater danger today than in days of dramatic happenings like the days of Elijah, because I am sure that the devil loves a state of what seems normality and even complacency in which to do his best undercover work. That's why I am so glad, this is my last word, this is why I'm so glad that our praying office bearers are so widely awake to the devil's wiles in our day. I think it's an inspiration from God himself that every Saturday evening we take a dealing with the devil, the enemy, before we come to the other prayer meeting and face a Sunday. Long may that continue, because I think it is paying and will pay yet dividends. And I pray may do so more and more.